Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It is Monday, April 1st. This morning, we learn about a possible solution to stopping the spread of the invasive grasses that fuel the Lahaina wildfires. Could they be used for fertilizers? And could a Molokai community group help shape policy in the White House? We hear about why it was included in a conversation with the Biden administration last week. We take a closer look at a disease that affects so many here in the islands. What can a garden teach us about managing gout? Tick tock, tick tock, time is ticking. Why content creators who are dependent on their influence on the social media platform are worried about a possible ban. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. What to do with all those invasive grasses? Well, that's the question prompted by the deadly Lahaina wildfires. The invasive species has grown out of control across the state. Here with one possible solution is HPR reporter Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me this morning.
Yeah, so what's going on the wildfire grassland front?
Well, apparently you can actually use fire-prone invasive grasses to make fertilizer. And there's this group of researchers who are a part of Simone Pietri Enterprises, which is a Hawaii-based local company. They recently, about maybe late last year, they received a grant from the U.S. Department of Energy, more than $200,000 to conduct research if they can make this organic fertilizer. And not only is this fertilizer made of fire-prone invasive grasses, they burn it into making it into biochar. So they put small amounts of that into the fertilizer, which is mixed with potassium and chicken manure, which are kind of the general ingredients that you find in conventional fertilizer that are sold in the markets or imported. And the way that they created the fertilizer, they tested it on two crops, one at Waimanalo Research Station and the other one at Pearl City Urban Garden. So they tested it on growing cucumbers and topsoy. And turns out those cucumbers, when I went on a recent Friday, they're over a foot long. So the fertilizer is doing pretty well, actually. It took about a month for these produce to grow. But I spoke with Naomi Cook-Hack, and she's the community engagement and communications person at Simone Pietri Enterprises. And she explains better how this fertilizer is made.
All of the fertilizers that created have some form of the invasive grasses. What that is in itself is we use a technology called gasification, a process called gasification, and out of that process, there is ash that's created. When you're using biomass, clean biomass like that, the ash that comes out of that is actually biochar. And so biochar is one of the ingredients that we are adding into the fertilizer, so all of our blends will actually contain a small amount of the biochar to help with various things, whether it's moisture retention, being able to increase the bioavailability of nutrients within the soil. So yeah, that's just going to be an added ingredient. It's just the other elements that we would add in, whether it's going to be how much of the chicken manure or other inputs, will determine our other blends.
So it's getting the recipe right.
Basically. And it's really interesting how they take invasive grasses, which is harvested by the native Hawaiian plant nursery Huiku Maliola and Kaneohe. They're the ones that are harvesting the invasive grasses around Oahu, but they're giving it to Simone Pietri Enterprises. And how they create this biochar, it's trying to simplify it, think of it as like you're burning wood, but there's no oxygen. And you know, when you're doing like a cooking fire and camping, it's the leftover potash in the bottom. They're taking that, and that's what's called biochar, and they're taking small amounts, which they're still testing, and putting it into the fertilizer, along with the chicken manure and potassium. Mm-hmm. When I went with them in Pearl City, kind of smelled like chicken manure coming to the office. So it was really interesting to hear how they're developing this type of fertilizer. But it's still in the beginning phases, so they're still testing out how much of this potash they can put into the fertilizer. But looking at what's going on with Wymanol and the cucumbers, I mean, they're over a foot long, so they're doing pretty good so far. But the next phase of this project, they would have to, they're looking for local farmers to see if they can volunteer their time and their crops to test this fertilizer.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that, you know, this could be a viable solution.
And the point of this project is they're trying to help local farmers and nurseries who are battling the rising costs of fertilizer nationally due to the COVID-19 pandemic, low inventory, and even the sanctions on Russia. According to 2022 stats, the U.S. has imported more than $13 billion in fertilizer. It's mostly coming from Canada and Russia. So that's a lot. And I know there's some farmers, they get to choose whether they want to use fertilizer or compost, but it costs a lot of money. And Joelle Simone Pietri is the owner of the Simone Pietri Enterprises, and she wanted to go back to her biology roots. And she says this project tackles a number of issues.
On the agricultural side with the fertilizer, again, we're trying to actually sort of address two problems at once. So one of them is we've got, you know, all this highly productive invasive species and landscaping waste and green waste, you know, just from the island of Oahu alone. Now it's got a third problem, which is that on the leeward side, it's very wildfire prone and we have this increasing wildfire risk. And then at the same time, the ingredients we make out of that are the same ones that farmers are paying to import and actually paying like as much as, you know, 40% more, sometimes twice as much, just in shipping costs to bring the exact same stuff from the mainland or from Canada or from Asia when we could be making it here. So we're trying to apply those problems against each other and come up with solutions for both or all three or all five by the time we're done. And again, the goal is to make a comparable product to what's imported today at a comparable cost. We're trying really hard to keep the cost down so that there doesn't have to be, you know, a made in Hawaii premium on it. And so that way our fertilizer and our soil amendments would be helpful to local farmers and also help, you know, keep one of their input costs down as well. I can't guarantee we will always be able to, you know, outprice fossil fuel based multinational product development, but we're trying.
Yeah, so it's really about sustainability and resiliency.
And it's also about making it more climate friendly without having all of these shipments of fertilizer coming here. And a lot of people want to grow things more locally, whether it's food or produce things more locally. So I know we were just talking earlier about how there's like other folks who are trying to use invasive plants for the biochar, which we have, let's say, I know Hawaii has about a quarter of its landscapes covered in invasive grasses and shrubs. That's according to researchers at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So this solution, we don't know if it's going to entirely get rid of invasive grasses, but because they're so fast growing, it's one solution to trying to keep it down at least.
It's a great idea. So, you know, kudos to those folks for trying to find a solution for a problem, which is, you know, top of mind because of the recent wildfires. And for the landowners that, you know, have a lot of their land in these invasive grasses, you know, can they hire folks to, you know, cut it and then provide them for the companies that are doing this? So, yeah, it's a wonderful idea.
And then hopefully the local farmers will get to try it out, because talking to some of the local farmers, like at Ahiki Acres, for example, I spoke with Haley McKinnon, and she said she uses mostly compost, but she's open to trying the fertilizer made from invasive grasses. But how much she spends is actually $3,000 a year per 25 cubic yards just for compost alone, and that's including with the shipping costs, which can cost about $400 to $600. For her.
Yeah, I mean, what a great idea. And so this company, has it been around for a while, or did they form, after the wildfires? I mean, do you know?
I believe they formed a little bit before the wildfires. So Simone Pietri, like, she wanted to go back to her biology roots, mm-hmm. and she was hoping to make sure that she can be a consultant company, but also her company's more focused on renewable fuels and innovative solutions.
Yeah, well, we'll see and hope that they're successful in their endeavors. But yeah, sounds like a great idea. But thank you so much.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been talking to HBR's Cassie Ordonio about the possibility of using invasive grasses for fertilizer. Look for stories on our website. But right now, we are going to take a break, and then we'll take a pause from regular programming for a test of the emergency alert system. Stay with us.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii State Health Insurance Assistance Program, SHIP. Learn more about volunteering to help people with Medicare at hawaiiship.org or by calling 808-586-7299.
Stories are the threads that weave our island communities together. From fish pond restoration efforts on Kauai to families recovering after the Maui fires, and more stories in between. HPR's local newsroom brings voices from across the islands to you. Statewide coverage is our commitment to you. Show your commitment to HPR with a monthly gift. Donate today at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Mobi, a Hawaii wireless company since 2005, featuring a locally based customer care team committed to problem solving and personal service for each client. Learn more at mobi.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Up next, your backyard quiz. Today we're looking at a condiment conundrum. In September 2013, a faulty pipe at Honolulu Harbor malfunctioned, spilling 1,400 tons of gooey liquid into the water. While no humans were harmed, the spill was disastrous for some local sea life. It's estimated that 17,000 coral and more than 26,000 fish and other aquatic animals were killed. Interestingly enough, the 2013 Honolulu Harbor spill marked at least the second time that a spill of this substance wreaked havoc with the states. In 1919, a spill at the Purity Distilling Company in Boston, Massachusetts, rushed through the streets at upwards of 35 miles per hour. The event injured 150 people and killed 21. For years after, local Bostonians claimed that you could still smell this sweet substance in the air on a hot summer day. For today's backyard quiz, can you tell us the name of the sweet substance that spilled in both Boston and Honolulu? Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NereidHawaii.com.
House is focused on an effort to build better communities across the country. Local elected officials and community leaders from around the U.S. Took part in an event last week focusing on Hawaii. Molokai'i nonprofit Aina Momono was among those invited to participate. It was started by longtime Hawaiian activist Walter Riddy, and the organization's vice president, Tricia Watson, was on hand to discuss its successful community-led programs on climate change and resilience. The conversation's Russell Subiono talked to Watson this morning about being involved in a meeting at that level of leadership.
Well, one, of course, it was incredibly exciting for us. I mean, as a community organization, to be able to communicate directly with, you know, senior officials in the White House was a phenomenal opportunity. It felt great to be even known by or seen at that level. So it was a really wonderful opportunity for us because we're primarily a very small grassroots organization.
I also read that Aina Momona planned to bring its priority issues to the discussion, including a just transition to a green economy and the importance of fostering inclusive solutions that prioritize marginalized communities, many of whom are on the front lines of climate impacts in Hawaii. Can you share what was discussed in the meeting?
It was a very interesting group because there were a lot of people from Maui and specifically for Lahaina. So there was lots of opportunity for those individuals to speak directly to elected officials. But for us on the climate side, we're in the White House's Justice 40 cohort, so the Justice 40 Accelerator. And Justice 40, for those who may not know, is a policy by the Biden-Harris administration that basically says they are looking to take 40% of federal grant funds for certain programs and ensure they get to frontline communities, disadvantaged communities, or basically the BIPOC community, Black, Indigenous, People of Colors community. So Aina Momona has, for a number of years now, been a part of national groups that have pushed for sort of this justice funding. A good example of that is the Ocean Justice Forum that we were a founding member of and helped to build the platform for. So basically, this Justice 40 program helps to make sure that funding that comes to state is not simply going to the people it's always gone to, but rather new organizations, well, not necessarily new, but new to federal funding, and these grassroots organizations that are creating jobs for local people, and in our case, Native Hawaiians. So it's a really exciting opportunity to have expressed our support for that program and the importance of that program for us and other organizations, because we really do think that it is critical as we move into sort of a green economy to make sure that those jobs are going to multi-generational local families and Indigenous people who've always been on this land.
I'm glad you brought up the Justice 40 initiative. I also read that that funding has enabled Aina Momona to substantially scale the organization's watershed restoration and climate adaptation work in rural Molokai and Oahu. And I read that you were recently awarded additional funding to expand work on Maui. Can you kind of talk about the specifics of the work that that funding has enabled Aina Momona to do?
Absolutely. Basically, our primary mission is restoration and conservation and justice. As you can imagine, in certain situations, that's not always the first thing people want to fund, but we feel like it's incredibly important. What we do is on-the-ground climate adaptation work. We take care of land, put in erosion control measures to stop flooding. So our first round of funding, which was when Kai Kahele was still congressman, was a grant to basically scale our effort. It was a substantial increase for our operational budget, and it let us do some really, really critical work with the NRCS, which is a federal agency that really focuses on soil conservation. So what we were able to do is work with that agency to come up with a plan where we basically can put erosion control measures on the mountain. So we did deer fencing, replanting of native plants, creating these sort of what are called swales. So they're basically large holes, almost troughs in the ground, if you can visualize them. And the idea is as flooding occurs, the water, instead of running off down the mountain, taking soil with it, flooding the roads and houses below, which is what was happening on our lands annually, the water stays on the mountain instead. And as a result, the soil stays on the mountain. And then again, with the planting, instead of having these sort of degraded brown areas that are not only on Molokai, but if you can imagine Kihei in South Maui and other locations, it basically restores these areas to be very healthy ecosystems where you're going to keep the soil on the mountain, you're going to keep the water on the mountain instead of running out into homes or running out into the ocean. So we've been able to do that. And with our first round of funding, we were able to do that on Molokai and then also on the windward side of Oahu, which of course also faces some very serious flooding issues. And then very thankfully to Senator Schott, we were given additional monies to do that work on Molokai, but then also to give funding to the Auahi Forest Restoration Program run by the incredible Art Madaris, which does reforestation on the Ulupalakua land on Maui. So that's sort of the immediate work we do. And what's also really great, you know, a lot of people like to use interns, they come and go, we create jobs, we create careers, we create well-paying jobs for local people so they're not having to take two or three jobs or they're not having to worry about covering their bills and possibly moving away. And this is work we do that we think is really important if we want to make sure that local people are going to have meaningful, good jobs and stay in Hawaii.
I think there's probably some people out there who look at this Justice 40 initiative, the partnership with the federal government on that and participating in the call, and they know how strongly Uncle Walter feels about Hawaiian sovereignty, and then they see kind of this partnership with the U.S. federal government. What would you say to those people who may be confused as to why Aina Momono was choose to do that?
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked it. I think a lot of people want to quietly ask us, but don't ever publicly ask us. So I thank you for asking the question. Uncle Walter, of course, has some very strong feelings about sovereignty, as does our entire organization. But I think we also recognize taking care of the land is really, maybe above that is not the right word, but it's the critical need right now. You can still have whatever feelings you have about politics in any scenario, and sovereignty is really a political issue. But taking care of the land is something we all need to come together about, regardless of your political affiliation, regardless of your political beliefs. We firmly believe that the land and taking care of the land and being sustainable around the land should unify people, not divide people. So it is a great question. We are very much people who support Native Hawaiian sovereignty, but at the same time, we're also aloha aina, right? And aloha aina, in the true sense of the word, means patriot, but it also means love of the land. And so for us, focusing on that love of the land, we kind of don't care about, you know, your politics or anything like that. So the federal government, if you're there to help us take care of our land so we can, you know, have land that is healthy, sustainable for our kids and our grandkids so that we can achieve food sovereignty to be able to feed communities, that's really the most important thing to us. And the agencies we've worked with, whether it's NRCS, USDA, NOAA, have been phenomenal partners. We know we don't know everything. And they have very much been able to come in with engineering advice, technology, different types of science that we're not familiar with that have absolutely helped to scale our restoration efforts and help to make our land healthy. And at the end of the day, anybody who comes sincerely wanting to partner on an effort like that is going to be welcomed. And what I tell people is often the perception of Uncle Walter, in fact, I was just with him yesterday and we were talking about this, is not necessarily how he is on a day-to-day basis. I think the media has picked up sort of the very high-profile contentious issues, of course. But from a day-to-day basis, he's actually kind of quiet, even goes so far to say that he's shy and he's very thoughtful, and he just loves to work on the land. At the end of the day, he is someone who loves the land and healthy land so much. He's turning 79 this month, so he turns 80 next year, and he is still there every day with whether it's a chainsaw or a pick or fencing. This is just his life's work, to take care and defend the land. And I think that is something, you know, I would encourage people to reach out to us and come and see what we do, whether it's on Oahu or on Molokai. And I think you would find that as much as we may be vocal on some issues, 99% of how we spend our day is taking care of the land. And I don't know, again, I hope that's something everybody would see the value in and importance of, especially, you know, when we are starting to experience such horrible storm events and disasters.
That was Aina Momona's Tricia Watson talking with HPR's Russell Subiono about taking part in a White House event focusing on building a better Hawaii. Watson says White House officials who participated in that event have already followed up with her.
You're tuned to member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. HPR has compiled a list of ways you can help with the Maui relief efforts. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org/helpmaui.
Support for HPR comes from PRX's Monumental, a new podcast confronting the reality of what's publicly commemorated and exploring questions about the past, present, and future of monuments. PRX.org/monumental.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Sam Daly Harris, author of Reclaiming Our Democracy. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about making the difference in the world you've always dreamed of making.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Do plants, kidneys, and gout have in common? Well, a lot more than you think. The Conversation's Lillian Song visited Weeded Gout, an immersive garden that popped up in Waikiki's Kapi'olani Park last month in conjunction with the Hawaii Kidney Walk. The campaign highlights the connection between gout and kidney disease. Amanda Frainer of Amgen explains.
We've got the garden here, so just like you don't want weeds to take over your garden, you don't want uric acid to take over your kidneys. Gout is one of those diseases that has been led by misconceptions. People often talk about diet and exercise, but what we really know from research is that it is a disease of the kidneys. And oftentimes your kidneys cannot remove uric acid well enough, which is why it builds up in the system. So it's really important to have these open dialogues where we're looking at it as a disease that requires the right management and the right amount of effort to just make sure that it's not getting out of control. But if you're having multiple flares a year, those painful moments where people know that they have gout, they can't put a sheet on because it touches their toe and their toe is inflamed or their knee is inflamed. But what we know is that uric acid can deposit nearly anywhere in the body. So even if you're thinking about it in your toe, it can be throughout the body. It just hasn't manifested in that area yet, hasn't built up. We know that the buildup of crystals tend to go where it's extremities, where it's cooler. So they tend to build up in the feet, in the knees, in the joints, but we know that they can build up in the organs. And just having a meaningful conversation about it as a disease, not just something where you have to change your diet, is really important because diet is such a small factor in why people have gout. Most of it, two-thirds of the reason that uric acid builds up is due to genetics, hereditary. It can be due to medications like anti-organ rejection medications, but really only one-third is related to the foods that you eat. So it's really important for those people with chronic kidney disease or a transplant to be aware of gout and to be talking with their doctor to be able to work with a specialist to manage that.
living with chronic kidney disease and gout. Retired firefighter Chance McDagone knows all about it. He shares his story of living with and working through painful flare-ups of gout. McDagone has seen his condition improve dramatically, though, after starting a new IV therapy. He suffers from a buildup of uric acid crystals on his joints called tophi that often shows up in places like the big toe or, in his case, on his elbow and under his heel.
As somebody who has lived with gout for 3 decades, first year of retirement, discovering how technology has advanced, understanding has really helped you. Why is it important to manage gout early?
For me, understanding and doing so much research and due diligence lately with all these new findings, the amount of damage that the gout and those little tophi crystals do to your joints over a prolonged period of time is unrecoverable. And to catch it early, to understand it early, and treat it with the best possible treatments early will avoid you with that long-term damage, because that damage you got to live with for the rest of your life. And a lot of, you know, local people in Hawaii go, oh, you know, uncle got gout, and he probably drank too much last night, and it's not really dove into. Where now, with the research, technology, and everything coming forward, that there's ways to get in front of it rather than treating something that you're just dealing with. It's a total 180 of how we all looked at gout. So the first time I ever got gout, I actually thought I sprained my ankle, and I treated it with Tylenol and then ibuprofen and rest and ice and tried to walk it off, and it just never went away. And I didn't understand it. It was very frustrating. And when I went to the doctors, they was like, you know, just give it time, it'll go away. And that same roller coaster ride, it must have went on for 2, 3, 4 years of not understanding it, not doing the proper blood work, not doing the proper research and getting out in front of it. We just kind of kept putting Band-Aids on a bullet wound, Band-Aids on a bullet wound. And that process, I think, is not unique in the world, especially in Hawaii, where a lot of local people have a pride of, I can tough this out. I can tough this out. And unfortunately, you know, you walk through the malls or at the airport and you go, oh, that guy got gout. Oh, that lady got gout. And it's an undeniable look of pain and discomfort. So I am happy and grateful that the technology and the research has been showing much, much improvement in understanding the actual gout and how and why it happens, and the relationship to the kidneys and your overall body mechanics. And it's not necessarily just food anymore or alcohol. For me, my triggers a lot of times was stress. I would be eating just fine and no alcohol intake, and I get a little bit of stress and my body would go a little bit acidic, and before you know it, gout attack. And I've tried every medicine under the sun over the last, you know, 30 years, and not with a whole lot of good result. Now, into my first year of retirement, I get to start off with a little bit quicker step and a little bit less limping, if you want to say, you know. Being a firefighter, we've been through a bunch of long days that we get dehydrated, and I was plagued a few times in my career with kidney stones. And the kidney stones, you know, are made of the same little deposits that are associated with gout. That was probably even more painful than any gout I've ever had.
So, like, when were you finally diagnosed?
It was in my mid-30s, and I started to get chronic pain, and it just wouldn't subside with any over-the-counter treatment. My doctor finally said, okay, you know what, let's send you to a blood test. And, you know, blood tests nowadays are so much more relevant and normal. But back then was, hey, we'll send you out. My blood test came back and my uric acid levels was at like a 13 or a 14, where a normal human should average 7 or below. So I was doubled. Yeah, so what a scary and unsafe place to be. And they have a lot of maintenance medicines out there that's supposed to help, but it's a very slow process with a lot of medicines that you have to commit to for years at a time to slowly bring your levels down a lot of people don't follow up, and you get a little bit of side reactions from it that people say, I'd rather deal with the gout. And then before you know it, 3, 4, 5 years go by and you're still dealing with this thing. So now with new technology, they can hit it straight on. They can bring you back to a point where, back to even again, and bring those gout levels down to zero. To have your blood level and your uric acid level at zero, that's like being born again, you know, and you have a whole new second shot. You kind of reset your body, reset everything, and all of a sudden your blood pressure starts coming down because you're not in chronic pain. Your kidney function starts to get stronger, better. Everything is a snowball effect that I'm so, so excited not only to be a part of, but to get others to try it.
Chance, you were dealing with gout for 30 years. So if you're sidelined with pain, gout.
All my outwardly extremities would be affected at different points of time. And luckily, being a fireman, you know, you have a crew of people around you. And a lot of times I was lucky enough where the gout wouldn't sideline me. It would just be extremely painful. It's a mindset of understanding that it's not an injury, but it's just very, very painful. If they had this technology and this information, you know, 30 years ago, I probably would have had a lot easier career. Yeah, we made it through and I'm super thankful. It never did really take me out of doing my job, but it sure made it uncomfortable. To me now is like, if we can spread the word and inform everyone that there's different ways to attack this thing and get in front of it rather than reacting to it is really life-changing for me. I was blessed to just have my first grandchild, and a second one is on her way. So I'll have back-to-back granddaughters, and I get so tickled to know that I'll be able to walk and run and play with these beautiful grandchildren, because it wasn't very long ago that my mentality was really, really saddened, thinking that, wow, you know, my shoulder is sore. I hope I can keep up with the grandchildren. And here we are, and I'm getting pretty darn good, and it's a whole new page in my life that I'm super thankful for. And by getting out in front of it, it's making this happen. So people out there, don't sit on it, get in front of it, and help yourself.
That was retired firefighter Chance MacDagon and HPR's Lillian Song. The Weed It Gout campaign coincided with National Kidney Month in March, which helps raise funds for research and advocacy. Now it's time to spill the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we reminded you of a devastating discharge into Honolulu Harbor that suffocated fish and other marine life over a decade ago. In 2015, the EPA and Matson reached a $15.5 million settlement over the spill. The money went toward regrowing coral, paying the state back for its cleanup efforts, and removing the pipelines that got them into the sticky situation in the first place. For today's backyard quiz, we asked you to name that gooey cooking condiment that spilled into Honolulu Harbor, and it was molasses. The sugary substance is also what was behind the Great Molasses Flood of Boston, which tore through the city's north end in 1919. We had lots of calls on this one. Our winner today, though, was Dana Ambrose from Kailua. That's our quiz. If you have one to share, write to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. The U.S. House of Representatives recently passed a bipartisan bill targeting the Chinese-owned social media app, TikTok. The bill would force TikTok's owner, ByteDance, to divest from the company within 6 months or face a ban. Lawmakers say TikTok poses a grave security risk and leaves U.S. users vulnerable to misinformation or cyber attacks. But some argue a ban would hurt small businesses and local influencers. Brian Mudumba is a content creator who's from Hawaii who goes by the name Brevenchi M on TikTok. He posts short videos that are often pretty funny, like this one.
To all my single ladies up here in Hawaii, let me tell you where to go to find a man. You need to stop going to the clubs, stop going to the bars, and you need to make your way to the Foodland Poke Department. Not at any time of the day, though. You need to go specifically at 5 o'clock p.m. through 6 o'clock p.m. Also, look at what kind of poke they buy. Are they buying cheap poke? Are they buying the fresh poke? Or are they buying a previously frozen one? And then, are they buying half a pound, 1 pound, 2 pounds? Now, girl, if they're buying 2 pounds, they're either buying 2 pounds for themselves and their boys or for themselves and their family. So you look to see if they have a wedding ring. If no more wedding ring, then boom, go get it, girl. Good luck. Bye.
The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to Mudumba about his thoughts on the ban and the challenges associated with running a business as a content creator.
I do think that there is some more research that they could have done before proposing the bill. And I think it's because I feel like there's going to be a huge socioeconomic impact, not just for creators, but businesses who invest so much time and money with TikTok. That's the part that concerns me. It's almost like if it does go through, it's going to be like a big layoff for creators almost, you know, like kind of that vibe that we saw in the past few years, but just for creators and also for the businesses who hire people specifically for TikTok marketing. February of 2023, I started posting content, and my content was not comedy. I actually wanted to go into creating more fashion and like style content because I've studied fashion in the past. So I have that passion. And then one day I just decided to do like a Hawaii content kind of video and it took off. So primarily I'm on TikTok and Instagram. I believe last time I checked TikTok, as far as followers, I think I was around 15,700. And then Instagram, I'm at 16.5.
And what is creating content for you?
Essentially, I would love to see it take off and become a full-time job that I would do because I truly do enjoy it. And, you know, being like this person who's in their 20s, I think I'm in that stage where I'm trying to figure out, like, what do I really want to do in life? And I'm having all these questions run through my head. It's interesting to see how much impact I could have. Currently, I do work in finance, but essentially, hopefully in the future, I do want to kind of stray away from that and then go in straight full-time into content creating.
Have you monetized any of the content you create?
Yeah, so actually this year, there's been a lot more brands reaching out to me. Through Instagram primarily versus TikTok. But TikTok has a creator beta fund, which pays its users to create videos and then it pays per view almost. But Instagram, it's better for reach to businesses. When it comes to working with brands, usually the creator would have like a media kit, which puts a price on how much they may charge per video, per story. So I do have one too, like on my website that brands can view. For a reel or a TikTok video, I do charge $125. For stories, it's like $25 to $50. Recently, I did work with Ronald McDonald House, but I did that pre bono. But if they were to pay me, I also offer like Instagram takeovers. And that would just be based on like whatever budget they have. A lot of the money that I do earn from TikTok or Instagram, I do try to reinvest it into like tools to create content. So like whether it's like a better tripod even or a better microphone, stuff like that. So yeah. I do kind of reinvest
into it. You know the power of good audio.
Yes. Yeah, it sounds so much better. So like even recently, I used it to like start a website.
How much time would you say per week you're putting into Instagram or TikTok at this point?
Oh, probably 10 hours, 10 to 15, sometimes less, sometimes more, but on the average, probably. It is very much a part-time job right now for me.
Have you been following the TikTok ban?
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely. And it's all over. It's all over both Instagram and TikTok.
Mm-hmm. What's the kind of thing that you hear among your circles?
To be honest, it's a lot of like comedy. There's a lot of comedy around it. Well, going into social media, like even though I can treat it like a business, at the end of the day, I wouldn't have these opportunities without my followers. So I know like on TikTok, I have, you know, like these 15,000 followers. And it would be definitely very sad and depressing to like lose them because I have built relationships with some of them, you know, online. That's like the unfortunate part. However, I know that a lot of them who are on TikTok also follow me on Instagram now. So at the end of the day, like, even though TikTok does have like that creator fun, I know I'll be losing that. But at the end of the day, it's not about the money. It's about always being there for my followers and showing up. So I will have one less place to do that. Yeah. But I think I'll still have that opportunity with another platform to continue on that. If TikTok does get banned, I think I'll probably move more into concentrating on putting more effort into Instagram and YouTube.
You have a lot of the same people following you on both Instagram and TikTok.
Yeah.
What if you didn't have Instagram, you know?
Oh, if I did not have Instagram, then I think I'll be a lot more nervous probably, because it is definitely hard to have people follow you both on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube. You know what I mean? It's like you're starting from scratch whenever you start a brand new platform.
How is the creator ecosystem for Hawaii? It does seem like your content is going directly to a real demand there is among people here to see something that represents them.
In Hawaii, we're so connected, whether we know it or not, due to like how we just interact with each other. We know we call everybody like auntie, uncle, and it's so small here, it's so tight-knit. So I think like once something blows up, it just keeps going and going and going with all your neighbors. Yeah, it's kind of like that.
One of the other interesting things that actually happened here recently was that a couple of weeks ago, the Hawaii House of Representatives honored Bretman Rock.
Oh, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, esteemed guests, and fans from Hawaii, it is a great honor to stand before you today to recognize and celebrate the remarkable achievements and career-defining accomplishments of an extraordinary individual, Bretman Rock. From his humble beginnings, creating backyard vines at James Campbell High School, to becoming a global icon and trailblazer, Bretman, you have captivated millions with your infectious personality, unparalleled talent, while along amassing over 50 million followers on your combined platforms. Bretman, your journey is a testament to the power of dreams and resilience of the human spirit.
When I saw that, that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I was like, that's pretty good, because I followed Bretman Rock since like the very beginning. So it was interesting. It was nice to see him earn that reward.
I think I saw on your Instagram that you called yourself the Kmart version
of Bretman Rock.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, and that came because somebody actually, that was one of the hate comments I got on TikTok. Somebody said like, who is this Kmart version of Bretman Rock? And I was just kind of laughing, and I was like, you know what? And I love to laugh at myself. I learned to take myself not too seriously. Just because there's two people here who kind of have the same energy doesn't mean that they can't both coexist. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of differences from me between him.
Is there anything that you wish listeners would know, especially people that don't have TikTok on their phone that might see it as this scary thing or not really understand what content creators do?
I think it's a great app because TikTok is that app where you can be a little bit more candid. You can be a little bit more of yourself versus Instagram, where it's more fine-tuned. So there is a great deal of connections within TikTok and genuine connections because of that candidness. I think there is a stigma that it's not a real job, or that, you know, why do they get to do all of these things for free and things like that? But when I really got into it and I studied social media content, you know, and I started going on Instagram, not just to scroll mindlessly, but to actually study people making videos. It's like, that's a lot of work. It does take a lot of time. And to be consistent, that's the part that is the most challenging. And it's not just taking a video and recording yourself. It's about thinking about what you're going to say, what you're going to do, making sure that you're in compliance with whatever rules that these applications have, and then the money that goes into all your equipment too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to just circle back to that point you made about it being like threatening layoffs. Like, what if we treated it like that? What if we treated it like it had the potential to cost Americans jobs?
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's a different perspective that I don't think a lot of people look at as well, because it helps run it. Like, a lot of these companies put a lot of money into influencer marketing and depend on it. And if you even look at a restaurant today, it's not by word of mouth, or it's not by like the quality of food. A restaurant does really well when they go viral on social media and they make these foods that look so appetizing and new, different. So they're not just a restaurant. They're also content creators, too. So there's a lot that goes behind when I say socioeconomic.
To bring it all back to Hawaii, it could really impact a lot of the smaller businesses here.
Yes, yes. Definitely. They're going to have to hop onto Instagram as soon as they can and keep posting. Yeah.
And if they need help, you can always do consulting.
Yes. Yes.
That was Brian Madumba, also known as Brivenci M on TikTok. He was talking with the Conversation's Maddie Bender. The TikTok bill is currently making its way through the U.S. Senate. President Biden has said he would sign the bill if it made it to his desk. Lawmakers say a ban may not be necessary if TikTok is sold. Well, that's it for us today. Tomorrow, we hear from a Big Island author about his new novel set on Mauna Kea and how his experiences gave him a deeper understanding. Do you have a story idea to share with us? Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.